Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
About 3 months ago, we featured a scholar discussing the economic and religious aspects of the Oracle of Delphi. It happened to be one of my favorite interviews, as the guest was very enthusiastic about the topic, and it was also one of those topics you don't think very much about, but when you hear somebody explain it, you scratch your head and you go, "Oh yeah, that makes perfect sense." Well, I couldn't resist getting this guest back on the program because my students recently read another one of her articles in my graduate course on religion and political economy, and it was a big hit. And now you know that the whole point of research on religion is to get great works of research out of the musty rooms of academia and into the ear holes and brain holes of the general public, so we're getting this right to you while it is still fresh in my mind. Regular listeners will know that that guest that I'm talking about is Colleen Haight, an associate professor of economics at San Jose State University, and one of the most eclectic scholars we've had on this show, in that she holds a degree in French literature, a PhD in economics, and in addition to writing about religion and economics, she is also interested in the regulation of champagne and coffee. You can't go wrong with either of those two topics. Today, though, we will be talking about Jewish peddlers and their role in the merchant economy. But we will also link back to our earlier discussion on sulfur-sniffing Greek virgins, because you do not want to miss that interview. It was a great one. And we'll also direct you back towards Colleen's other works, of which I am a big fan. Colleen, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you very much, Tony. It is a pleasure to be with you again. I truly enjoyed the last time we chatted, and I'm looking forward to today as well.
Yeah, it was a fun one. It was a really fun topic. This one is equally as fun, so it'll be very interesting to do this. And I have to mention that I have had a number of repeat guests here on the show, but you might be the one person who has the biggest turnaround, appearing after only about 3 months. I think the only other person to do this was Rod Stark when we were doing a series of podcasts on one of his books, but I guess that puts you in really good company there.
Wow, I'm honored. Actually, Rod Stark's work came to my attention early in my academic career when I read his Victory of Reason, How Christianity Led to Freedom, Capitalism, and Western Success, and I found his work so enlightening that I thought, wow, I know this isn't traditional economic work, but there's stuff here that really needs to be looked at with an economic lens. So his work has been quite influential, and I'm honored to be in the same group.
Yeah, and it's not only that he raises interesting questions that you can see through an economic lens, but his writing is so wonderful. I mean, it's not the typical academic writing that, you know, you're building economic models around or filled with lots of jargon, but it really pulls the reader into this, and your work does this as well.
Well, thank you very much. I think economics can be a really interesting thing, but if you hide it behind a lot of math, you lose a lot of people. So I try to keep it simple, straightforward, and just communicate the ideas. That's what's interesting about economics, not necessarily always the math.
Yeah, and you do this with your article. The article that we're going to be talking about today is called Hostile Territory, High Tension Religion and the Jewish Peddlers. We will link to that article. I know some people might not be able to access it because it's behind a journal paywall, but if you are able to get a hold of it, it is a very good read because it's filled with lots of interesting history as well as economic theory without all the mathematical stuff, right? So that's the stuff that turns off people, but your stuff brings it in. And the article also meshes very well with a number of other folks we've had on the podcast in the past few months, including Larry Iannacone and Gary Richardson. Gary Richardson just did Craft Guilds a few weeks ago, so that will be a good way to blend all this stuff together. So we're going to ask folks to go back to our archives and find that stuff. Let's start out with my typical question for scholars, and that is, what got you interested in this topic specifically of Jewish peddlers?
That's a good question. Economics and religion came to my attention first when I met Larry Iannacone as a graduate student. He was my graduate dissertation advisor. And just talking about the many different ways religion impacts our lives, I guess generated an interest in the field overall for me. And if you think about it, there are so many fascinating things out there to study. People are baffling in so many different ways. You know, why do we do the weird things that we do? And to some extent, you have to think of what would aliens think of if they were just landing on the planet or hovering above us and observing. And once you take a step back and look at some of the things we do, you think, wow, that really would appear odd to the outsider. On the other hand, as the insider, you know exactly why you're doing what you're doing. And that's where economics comes in to illuminate. Economics is simply just a set of tools we use to look at the world and help us determine why do people do the weird things they do.
I want to stop and challenge you on something that you just said, and I'll let you continue in a second. But you talked about the hovering aliens looking down at us going, I wonder why they're doing those things. And then you talk about people doing the things that they do and knowing that they do those things. Is that always the case, though? Because this might be one of these cases that people follow traditions. They're not really knowing why they follow traditions. And I think a lot of economics, a lot of social behavior is wrapped around doing things that we don't even know why we're doing them, but yet they have a economic logic to them.
Oh, I have a perfect example of that. For years, since we're coming into the holiday season, for years we spent Christmas Eve at my aunt's house. And my aunt would make oyster stew for the entire family. The entire family got together. This was the tradition. Now, when you talk to the individual family members, you realize that there wasn't a single person who really liked that oyster stew. It was part of the cost of going to the family reunion, not part of the benefit. But we all did it in spite of it, and we all told her how wonderful that oyster stew was, even though none of us really thought it was all that wonderful. So if you think about it, why would that tradition persist? Well, it's because there are so many other associated benefits to that tradition that it goes ahead and continues, even though it's sort of baffling. Why would you go to eat oyster stew when everybody hates oyster stew? So if you look at that, what are the benefits? Well, of course, it was the family feeling, the traditions of getting together and singing at the piano and just seeing everyone outweighed the cost of having to endure the oyster stew. Now, when Aunt Faith asked us, did you like your oyster stew? We, of course, all said, yes, it's wonderful. We're so glad. Thank you for inviting us over. Not because we were eager to have oyster stew again, but because the rest of the environment was so rewarding that we wanted the tradition to continue in spite of the cost, if that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. I've had the same thing with my grandmother, who made very dried pot roast and bland cauliflower with no butter or anything on it. And my father told me, you know, every Sunday when we went over, you better tell grandma that you really like that thing. And I'm like, but, you know, I don't really do. And, you know, there's the aspect that if you tell your aunt that you don't like the oyster stew, or you tell grandma that you don't like her pot roast, she stops having you over, and all that other stuff, the fellowship that occurs around the family meal, disappears. And so you don't want to do that. So a lot of our niceties, our politeness, actually have this economic logic of bringing together people collectively.
Absolutely. Traditions all have some reason for existing. And because we all honor those traditions in some way or another, the traditions persist because they continue to bring the benefits that are associated with them.
Okay. So I interrupted you when you were explaining how you're getting from the economics of religion to specifically Jewish peddlers. And so I'm going to let you go ahead and continue that thought, as well as apologizing for our listeners for that short little tangent.
Oh, no worries. Actually, it was just a sort of a random walk, if you will, through the different thoughts on religion. And one of the things that struck me is a lot of the religious behavior that's out there is very separating. And people, well, we hear it all the time, you can't trust that group because, you know, they do a lot of terrorist activity, or you can't trust that group because, well, they're wealthier than everybody else and they must be cheating people. And you hear these things and you realize there's, with religion, there seems to be a great deal of hostility. I don't want my children associating with that group over there because I can't trust their moral fiber. And with regard to Jews in particular, the question that always came up in my head is, okay, Jews have been chased out of more countries than one can count. They have been maligned throughout the ages for their beliefs or for being different in some cases, and no more than being different. They're often chosen as scapegoats for things that happen that are really not even closely associated. So being a Jew, in that sense, is quite costly. So you would think that if there were all costs and no benefits, that you would see a lot fewer Jews today, as people said, you know, it just isn't worth it. If I want to be religious, there's a number of great religions out there. We all believe more or less the same good things. You be nice to people, don't kill, don't cheat, don't steal. And maybe I should just switch. So why aren't people switching? Why aren't they becoming members of religions that are widely accepted? And that was a puzzle to me. So as I looked back on what this call to be Jewish is, and yes, I understand there's a difference in the beliefs, there's a lot of reason to be Jewish, but there's also a lot of reasons not to be. So why do we still see Jewish people? And of course the answer to that is, if you look at economics, you say, well, there's all these costs to this particular type of behavior, but if people are doing it anyway, it means that there are also benefits, and that those benefits to those people outweigh the costs. Now, when you think about it, you can say, okay, well, maybe that's just, you know, the devout religious belief that's there, the observance, the traditions, they all mean something. But there has to be more than that, because there's, again, there's a lot of good religions out there that have nice stories, nice traditions, nice belief systems that are a little less difficult to belong to. You don't get chased out of countries for your beliefs. So again, why is that? So I started to look into this, and that's when Larry Iannacone actually pointed out, gee, you know, this may have nothing to do with it, but have you noticed that the peddlers in U.S. history seem to be all Jewish? And do you realize there weren't that many Jews in the U.S. during that time period? Why is that, do you think?
Mm-hmm.
And from that conversation, this story was born. I started looking into the history of peddlers in the U.S. during, in particular, from about 1800 to 1900, and came up with this story that said, yes, everyone was Jewish. Well, why is that? Well, let's look into that a little bit. First of all, there weren't any other jobs that were available. Again, in this country, a predominantly Christian country for the most part at that time, Jews did not assimilate necessarily very well with the rest of the community. And for that reason, they didn't get jobs. So what jobs were available? Those jobs that nobody else wanted to do. Now, that should be a similar theme, because if we look at immigrants today of any variety, doesn't necessarily stand with religion. It can just be, well, in California, we have a lot of immigrants from Central America. What jobs do they do when they come to California? The jobs that the Californians don't want to do. Because we either have levels of education that make other opportunities available to us, language skills, etc. They are willing to do the jobs that we are not. And that was true of also the Jewish peddlers.
I liked how you put it when you were talking with Larry, and he just pointed out, hey, did you ever notice that the Jews were really influential in this industry, even though there weren't that many of them? It's one of those moments in science that you go, that's kind of odd. And in fact, most people think science is one of these eureka moments. You just stumble on an answer. It's actually more interesting to stumble on a question. And as I talk to my graduate students, I say, you really got to get good at making observations and scratching your head and saying, you know, that's kind of odd. I wonder why that is, because that opens the door to a whole brand new study. And it's something that people don't necessarily see when they're in the middle of that situation. I mean, if you had asked somebody back in the 1800s, why are there so many Jews in the merchant business? And they would say, well, that's just how it is.
Right.
And you have to kind of step back and look at it from a different angle in order to see the interesting aspect of this. And this raises an issue I want to ask you, because you are so eclectic in your interest. And that's the kind of scholarship that I like. I mean, a few months ago, we had you back talking about ancient Greek oracles. You've done stuff on fair trade coffee. Now you're doing stuff on Jewish peddlers. Do you get any pushback from individuals in academia that say, Colleen, how could you possibly study ancient Greek oracles and 19th century Jewish peddlers? You're not an expert in this.
That's true. And I actually don't get as much of that as you might think, mostly because I'm using the same tools. I'm basically using these economic ideas and concepts and using it to illuminate different behavior. So while you may say, okay, the Oracle at Delphi, Jewish peddlers, I'm working on a paper now that looks at twin killings in African tribes and tribal religions. These are radically different types of venues, but at the same time, the economic tools aren't that different. I'm still looking at, well, there's something unusual going on here. Let's see if we can use economics to shed some light on why these things are happening. And there's always, or traditionally in my work, there is some bit of history involved, because I find the stories, the circumstances in which these different behaviors arise to be very interesting. So, yes, it does tend to be diverse, but you know, the other thing is sometimes you just stumble upon a really interesting question, and you have to follow it down the rabbit hole. So that's what I've done with these stories, also with the fair trade coffee that I've been researching. I've done some work on industrial waste that was a paper that was just released in Resources Conservation and Recycling. And that paper looks at squandered profit opportunities, actually. Why is it that, you know, suddenly we have all of this interest in recycling and we think we need to push this through government regulation? Well, do we really have to do that? Or historically, do we see that we've been doing that all along? And this paper looks at, well, how people have used to throw things out that are useful, discovered that they were useful, and created products out of what basically used to be industrial waste. So economics is an interesting way to look at the world, and it does help you answer a variety of questions.
I am going to get my hands on that industrial waste paper, because outside of religion, environmental issues are of great interest to me. So that'll be fascinating. We'll point people back to that as well, because again, your scholarship, very eclectic, but also extremely interesting, because you bring these general tools of economics to the study of this wide range of human behavior throughout time. And before we get to talk about a specific moment in time, the 19th century and Jewish peddlers, let's talk about one of the economic tools or concepts or theories that you actually use. And this is one of the reasons I like this paper a lot. You start off with a Nobel-winning economist, George Akerlof, who happens to be one of my favorite economists. And he wrote a very famous paper about lemons. And it's, how could a paper about this delicious citrus fruit have anything to do with Jewish peddlers?
Well, not that much. Citrus fruit, perhaps not. But when Akerlof was talking about lemons, he was actually talking about the used car market, among other things, the market for lemons.
Ah, lemons as cars, not as things you put in your iced tea.
Absolutely. Ah. Faulty products. How do we protect ourselves from faulty products, and what impact do they have on the market? So theoretically, what Akerlof says is if you're thinking about, say, the used car market, there's a problem here because it really shouldn't exist at all. When you go to buy a used car, as a buyer, you have no idea if that car is going to be good, a good car or a bad car. So when you approach someone, you may say, oh, well, they're asking $10,000 for this used car. I'll offer them $5,000 because I'm not sure it's really worth $10,000. Now, the seller, on the other hand, has all the information about the car. They know whether or not it's a lemon or a good car. So they are going to price it accordingly. Now, what this means is if it's a good car and they price it $10,000, the car is probably worth $10,000. But you as the buyer don't know that, and you won't offer $10,000, which means that no one's going to offer that good car. Good used cars, theoretically, then, should actually disappear from the market because no one's going to believe that they're that good and they won't pay the price. Therefore, the only remaining cars on the market would be bad cars that are overpriced, so no one's going to buy them. Therefore, the market for used cars shouldn't exist at all. And this is all based on what we call the asymmetric information problem, in that one party to a transaction has all of the information, and the other party has none of the information. Well, if we look out in the world, I don't know about you, but I've bought several used cars in my lifetime, which means that even though theory says this market shouldn't exist, it actually does. But why? And that's what becomes, again, the interesting question. If theory says this should not be happening, and yet it is happening, then we're not seeing the whole picture, and that's where economics comes in. So what's the solution? Well, there's many solutions, as it turns out. Entrepreneurs have done a great deal to improve this market. So if you think about it, back in the day, as an aging economist, I can say that when I bought a used car, you looked up in the newspaper, in the want ads, found someone, met them on a street corner somewhere. Perhaps you brought along a friend who knew something about cars, because I certainly didn't. Or you maybe even said, I'll meet you at my mechanic's shop so he can look over the car, and then we'll figure out whether it's actually worth it. You take a guess, and you either buy the car or not. But today, we don't normally do that because entrepreneurs have rushed in to fill this gap. And one way that that's happened is the lovely thing known as Carfax. If you want to know what's happened to a car, Carfax is an institution that has taken all of the publicly available information, stuff that you could search out there and get and collect, but it would take forever to do it. They've already done it for you. They sell it to you. You can find out, has this car been in an accident? And then you can make choices from there. The other thing that's happened is we're relying a lot on reputation. And this has happened in the past, but today, if you want to buy a car, you might go, say, to the Mercedes dealership and buy the certified pre-owned vehicle. They don't call them used anymore.
No.
Pre-owned vehicles. And you know that when you're buying it and it's certified, that, of course, somebody has checked it out and they've repaired any flaws and now it's basically as good as new. Or if you buy a refurbished iPhone, you have some guarantee that the phone is back in usable condition and no flaws exist. So these types of things help us. The entrepreneurs have solved the problem, but also this reliance on reputation. If I buy a certified pre-owned car from Mercedes and it turns out to be a lemon, I can go back to Mercedes and they'll fix it. And I know they're going to be there because of their reputation. So that's a nice thing. In fact, if we look at reputation, why do you buy certain foods that you buy, and where do you buy them? Do you buy stuff off the street, or do you wait and buy it at a grocery store who, you know, you have a relationship and in the past they've proven that they're going to give you good produce or stand behind their products. So if you're dissatisfied with something, you can take it back and they'll refund your money.
Yeah.
That reputation that makes the market work.
Yeah, there's a lot of signaling that goes on with this reputation as well, in that if you're talking about buying food, you go buy some fruit off the side of the road stand. Sometimes you do because, you know, it looks kind of nice, but a lot of times we don't. You go to the supermarket that looks really nice and clean because you figure, well, if they're a nice and clean supermarket, or if they're a nice, well-kept used car dealership, they're probably also going to be offering quality products, quality fruit, quality used cars as well.
Absolutely. And in fact, signaling has been something that we've relied upon in the past. If you think about the banking industry, one of the reasons we have all of these huge bank buildings that, you know, look like Greek temples is because really what it is they're saying, we're permanent. You can give us your money and we will be here tomorrow. You don't necessarily take your money and give it to Joe's fly-by-night, I'm in the back of a van bank, because where's he going to be tomorrow?
Yeah.
Right? And this is actually, this brings up an interesting thing with the Internet, because when the Internet businesses first started, I remember my parents saying, oh, you can't do banking over the Internet. You don't know where the bank is. Well, okay, that's true, and, you know, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, all of the major banks are right down the street, and I know where those buildings are. I didn't necessarily know where the Internet banks were. Of course, today it's changed a little. The banks that are permanent out there, the big guys, all have Internet banking because, well, we trust them. Their reputation says that they will be there tomorrow with your money.
Yeah. I'm having a hard time now with Bitcoin. All my friends are telling me to go into Bitcoin, but I'm going like, I don't know where the bank of Bitcoin is. So that there's that. I guess this brings us then to the Jewish peddlers. And the mystery deepens here a little bit, because merchants back in the 19th century had a very similar problem to the lemons problem, is that, you know, they're coming and going. You're not sure what they're selling you, and it's a transient type business. And this has been one that not only affects the 19th century, but throughout history. And in your paper, you note that one of the more interesting things that historians have noted is that people who serve as middlemen or merchants and get goods from one person to another often have tended to be minority groups, and very distinct minority groups. What has been the thinking about why minority groups fill this role, which must require a great deal of reputational investment?
Ah, that is a great question. The poor maligned middleman. You know, any time I'm talking about middlemen, I'm reminded there is a jewelry store in our area. I think they're up in your area as well. They bill themselves as the direct diamond importer because they have cut out the middleman to save you money.
Yeah.
And every time I hear, you know, that ad or variation of it, I just have to chuckle to myself and say, you know, that's just, I hate to say it, that's patently stupid. Because the middleman doesn't cost us more money. They actually save us money. And I think people just totally misunderstand the role of the middleman. So just to make sure we're all on the same page here, let's go back to our grocery stores. I live in a fairly urban area. I'm in between San Francisco and San Jose. And let's just say if I want steak for dinner, I couldn't tell you who has a steer out there that I could go and find, and I wouldn't know who could, you know, butcher the animal for me, because I certainly don't know how to do any of that. If I wanted some vegetables, it's the wrong time of year for a lot of the things that I like to eat, so I might have to fly down to Chile to get something that's fabulous. So just the simple act of putting dinner on the table without the middleman, and the middleman in our area, Lucky's, Safeway, all of the big, you know, chain grocery stores, plus all those mom-and-pop stores. Without them, my dinner would be so horribly expensive that I would never eat. And I would have to rely on what I could grow in my garden. And I have to tell you, I don't have a green thumb. So the grocery store, that middleman, saves me so much time and effort in putting a meal together on my table that I should really send them letters of thank you every day that I have a meal. So we need to keep that in mind. If we had to serve as our own middlemen, then what we're doing is we're really increasing our costs because of the search costs that it takes to get those supplies that we look for and now we find so easily because of the middleman.
Mm-hmm.
So why is the middleman then so distrusted or maligned? And if you think about it, it's because they don't produce anything.
Yeah.
What does the middleman do? The middleman goes to you, offers you a low price for a product, brings that same product to me, marks it way up, and sells it to me. Well, why should he get the profit? You made the product. You're the one that should be getting all of that profit, if anybody gets the profit. Or why should I, the end user, be cheated when you would be willing to sell it to me for much less? So again, we forget that, well, the middleman had to go find you, and then he had to go find me in order to bring us together in a transaction when neither of us knows each other. So that middleman serves an incredibly important role in the economy. We just forget that. Now, let's talk a little bit more about who this middleman is. Generally, again, because people don't appreciate what the real role of the middleman is, it's not an occupation you send your kids into.
Yeah.
So if you are a wealthy family and you're trying to direct your kids into good occupations, it might be, go be a doctor, go be a lawyer, go be, you know, some professional out there, but we don't want you hawking stuff on the street, so to speak. Or you might say, we produce furniture in this family, and we've had this family business creating this wonderful artistic furniture for years. This is a noble profession because you're creating. Well, okay, that's true. What is the middleman creating? You can't point to it. So those occupations, the majority population that is already, you know, able to get any job they want because they're part of the majority population, they will send their children into the occupations that seem more reasonable to them. What's left, then, are these holes in our economy, generally filled by middlemen, generally filled by people who can't get the other jobs. So if you think the banking industry, investment banking today is a little bit different than it was in the past. There used to be the religious prohibitions on it, but it seems like if you're going to be in that position, you have to already be established in a community in order to have access to those jobs. So our immigrants that come into the U.S. today generally don't. So where do we find our immigrants? We find them running the corner 7-Eleven or the convenience stores because those are jobs that aren't really appreciated by people. You don't really think of them as being, well, the jobs that the professions you would want push your children into. Although they're great professions. They provide for the families. Generally speaking, they have these markets in small, perhaps not great neighborhoods that serve that neighborhood. The families work very hard. They produce something. But when you go into these neighborhoods and look at these little markets, you find that, generally speaking, they are the people who own them and run them are not part of the majority population. They're part of a maligned minority population, an immigrant population of some sort. So we find our immigrants flock to those areas of employment that are, I guess, our normal U.S. citizens who are part of the majority population simply are no longer willing to do. Their ancestors may have done these jobs, but they've worked their way up the economic ladder in some respect.
So that explains some of this. But there's more to it, specifically when it comes to the case of merchants, we get back to the lemons problem, because, you know, I don't know if I can trust these merchants, especially back in the 19th century when, you know, I don't know if those goods, I didn't have Carfax to, you know, check the wagon out and to kick the wooden wheel to see if it was good or not. So you start bringing in some stuff about high tension religion and then the role of hostility, which I think is very interesting. Explain how this works with the Jewish peddlers.
All right, let's start with you personally. We'll get personal here for a minute.
Okay.
So let's say you belong to the local church and you need a plumber. And you don't happen to know a good plumber. So where are you going to find? Well, you could ask your friends, or you could pick up a local copy of the church bulletin when you're there and, oh, look at that. Joe Smith advertises in here. He's a member of the church. He's a plumber. I need a good plumber. I need someone I can trust who's not going to cheat me. Joe's a member of my church. I know something about his moral fiber. So let me call Joe and get him over here instead of looking someone up in the Yellow Pages, although nobody uses Yellow Pages anymore.
Hmm.
Why do you choose it? Well, you choose someone within your trust network. The cool thing about religions is if you belong to a religion, you know that there are certain tenets of that religion that you're going to follow or attempt at least to follow. And anyone else who belongs to the religion has those same values. So if they belong to your religion, it's quite possible that you either know them or have some interaction with them or know people who do. This is a person who has the same moral beliefs and cultural beliefs that you do. It's quite likely you can predict that he will treat you honestly. We still don't know if he's the best plumber in town, but at least we know he's honest. And that's a pretty big deal. Now, what if he isn't honest? What if he comes to your house and he leaves it in worse shape than it was and he overcharges you? Well, what happens? Well, there is a possibility you could be so angry that you tell all of your friends at church how awful he was to you. What happens? The rest of the people at church don't use him. They spread the word within the community there, and he basically is not trusted anymore within your community. So the religion can serve as a proxy for trust in that sense. Now, how does that work when we get to the middlemen? Well, if we're talking about middlemen back in the 19th century, we have to look a little bit more closely at the role that they played. These were basically poor men that came as immigrants, normally not speaking a lot of English. They would speak some German, but primarily these people spoke Yiddish. They, again, did not conform to the social norms prevalent in the United States during the 1800s. So they stood out. They looked different. They were not necessarily going to be hired in the normal, I would say, majority types of occupations. Nobody was going to get to be a school teacher because, well, you just look different. I don't know that I want you around my kids because I can't trust where you're from because I don't really know much about you except that you're very different from me. So we're not going to put you in too many positions of trust. At the same time, what types of occupations did Jews specialize in traditionally? Well, this goes back to, again, being a distrusted minority and sometimes despised minority. Jews, again, were kicked out of a lot of countries. If you are going to have a lot of investment in something, you can invest in a few ways. You can invest in education. You can invest in financial capital of some type. You can invest in a big storefront. There are lots of ways that you can, you know, invest in yourself. So what does a typical Jew invest in? Well, if you are in fear of having to move rapidly, let's say that the political climate is uneasy, you may have to relocate your family because your religion is going to make it very difficult for you to live. If that's the case, then the types of assets you invest in are going to be easily movable assets. So what we find then is that Jews traditionally have invested in things like education and financial things that can be easily moved. If you think about the diamond industry, again, it's an industry where there are a lot of Jewish people involved. If you think about having to pick up and move, your financial assets or your assets are pretty easy to relocate if they're diamonds. You can pack them all away and move them quickly. If your assets instead are in a factory and you have to move, you're leaving behind your wealth. So with this, we find that the Jewish people tended to specialize in areas where they could make a difference or where other people couldn't specialize, and in particular those areas where there was an ability to relocate. So we find that merchants tended to be Jewish. Lenders tended to be Jewish because, again, if you're a middleman, you aren't producing, so you don't have a factory, and you can easily relocate.
Yeah, this was one of the most fascinating things of the article, which was filled with a lot of other fascinating things. We're going to get to the hostility aspect here in a minute. But the idea of mobile assets, that if you get kicked out of every place, you develop a comparative advantage in things that are easy to move when you get kicked out, including being a merchant, as moving from community to community and trying to fit into someplace entirely new. That's what you start to specialize in.
Absolutely. Now, here's another thing that's interesting, and this is broader than just, you know, religious minorities. This goes for all types of ethnic groups that relocate, say, to the United States. Have you ever wondered why it is? The city that I live in, Redwood City, we have an enormous amount of people from Michoacan, Mexico. If you go to New York, you don't find a lot of Mexicans. You find more, say, Puerto Ricans or people from the Dominican Republic. So why is it that everyone clusters in one little group? Well, again, it's because you have these networks, and it's almost, you can relate it to game theory. People, if you and I are immigrating to a country and we both go, we can both rely on each other and help each other out. And make ourselves better off, and we can start to leverage the network because we know other people. Maybe there's another family from our village that's there, and they can hook us up with a job or a place to live, even though we don't speak the language yet, right? So you find that there's clusters of people that move together, and this also happens with religious groups. Again, it's because if you have a network in place, it's going to make your assimilation in that country more easy. So when we have all of the Jewish settlers coming in the middle of the 18th century or 19th century, we find that they first did approach their networks. First, they weren't trusted by the majority population necessarily because they were too different. Second, they didn't speak the language well. So they went to people who would trust them and were able to speak their same language. Those people then could help them out. How could they help them out? Well, they can't necessarily give them jobs at the store in New York, but what they could say is, you know, I can't get out to those distant suburbs over there or that next state, but if you could take some of this on a mule and sell it over there and come back, then that provides enough of a service for me that, you know, we can make some arrangements here.
Give us an idea of what that was like in the 1800s. And you mentioned that the Jewish population starts to expand during this period of time. Also give us a sense for the demographics of the Jewish population from, I don't know, say about 1800 to about 1880, the time span that your study covers. And then just how was it like to be a Jewish peddler, or just to be a peddler in general? And why was that important?
Being a peddler was not easy work by any stretch of the imagination. First of all, you didn't own anything. You're a traveling salesman. You're a fuller brushman, basically. So what you do is you go to someone you know who has some ability to loan you credit. Now that's a huge thing because without the credit, you can't buy anything. You have no money. So you have to find someone to loan you money. The majority people are not going to loan you money because they don't trust you. They don't know who you are. You don't speak the language, and you're different. So you go to the people who understand you. They might be willing to make you a loan because, of course, you're not different to them. You're the same. You're part. They know something about your moral fiber. It's the same as theirs. Your traditions are not weird to them. So they are going to perhaps trust you where other people would not trust you. As we then move forward in the life of the Jewish peddler, once they get that trust and they're given some credit, what they would do is they would load up, you know, if they had to travel on foot, which many of them initially did, they traveled on foot with whatever they could carry. They would graduate up to a horse or then to a horse and a wagon and go out into the frontier. During the period of the largest wave of Jewish immigration, this coincided with the expanding of the U.S. frontier westward. So these peddlers would load up wagons as heavy as they could and take them out into the new areas, say into South Dakota from New York. Well, that's an awful long way to trust someone. So let's say I trust you, I'm going to give you a bunch of stuff, and I'm going to send you off in a wagon where you can sell the stuff for cold, hard cash, which, of course, you owe back to me. But what's going to keep you from just saying, well, I'm in South Dakota now, I have all this cash, why don't I just buy a farm out here and, you know, see what happens? Well, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
Well, there's a reason why the peddlers wouldn't. First of all, they don't have any community out there. If you think about the traditional Jews who filled these roles, these were people who were very religiously observant. They have all sorts of restrictions. So first of all, they look different from everyone because they're dressing differently. There is a lot of facial hair, for example. You have beards, you have side curls, perhaps. You have heavy woolen coats. You have caps on your heads. The women, the few women that are around, are all wearing scarves over their hair because you can't expose your hair. You visually are quite different than the majority population. So you look a little bit different. You don't speak the language well. You also do something else that's strange. You refuse to work from sundown on Friday till sundown on Saturday. And that's strange because that is a work day for everyone else in the world at that time. But you can't do that because your religion asks you to have that day of rest, to take a break. And it prevents things from the basic things. Like you aren't even, if you take it to the full extent, you cannot build a fire in the wintertime because building a fire could be construed as a form of work. So you may not be able to get warm. You may not be able to ride in a buggy to go someplace because riding in a buggy is a form of work. So you cannot travel. You need to have a quorum of people with which to pray because this is a day of prayer, but you need the right number of people in your quorum so that you can have these prayers. So you need to be around other people of your same religion. You also have a problem eating, and this is where it gets really difficult because think of all of our social traditions. They almost all revolve around food. I mean, in my example earlier of my aunt's oyster stew, our gathering, our tradition revolves around food. And that's true of many social occasions. But for traditional Jews, they kept kosher, which meant that they not only couldn't eat pork, I mean, that's the one that almost everybody knows, but any form of meat that is permissible had to be butchered, of course, according to rabbinical law and within the constraints of the religion. So if it wasn't done by a rabbi or in a facility controlled by the rabbinical guidance council, then, of course, it wasn't kosher meat, so you couldn't eat it. you were confined to, say, vegetables. Fish could be problematic. If it has fins, it's okay, but no form of shellfish is allowed. You might have to be very careful of what you're eating. You can't then just go to someone's house for dinner because you would not be able to eat what they offered you. So this separation of food earned most of the Jewish peddlers during this time a unique name among the Cherokee Indians with whom they did a lot of trading as well. They were referred to as the egg eaters because the egg, the hard-boiled egg, is the perfect kosher food. And it is absolutely ideal. It is uncontaminated in any way. So that there was a lot of egg eating, and if you didn't have eggs, you were essentially a vegetarian. So let's say you go out into the field with your wagon, you end up in South Dakota. Well, if there aren't any other Jewish people there, you pretty much are on your own. And you may say, okay, that's okay, I'll just blend in with a majority group. Well, in order to blend in with a majority group, you now have to give up some of the basic tenets of your belief system. And if you do that, then there's a problem there because you may get in trouble with your God. And that's a problem. So you can't necessarily defect. On the other hand, you know, if you're going to steal from the group that has supported you, you can't go back to them either. So you end up being all on your own. You cannot fit in anywhere. You have no prospects for community or for finding a wife or anything else. You're it. You're done. So what we find then is the Jewish peddlers who were entrusted with so much credit never defaulted on that credit, because if they did, they would not only be on their own, they would ruin their own social network that they had belonged to, but they also wouldn't belong to any other social network because no one else would take them.
You'd just be floating out there in space with nowhere to go.
All on your own.
Yeah. So how does hostility work into this? Because this is a period in history, in American history, that anti-Semitism is on the rise. And you're having these people who don't quite speak the language, they don't eat the right food, they're wearing funny clothes, and they're coming to sell me stuff, right? I mean, one, you can kind of get this understanding of how people, you know, your typical Irish-American who's out there in South Dakota is, you know, viewing these people is like, I don't know if I can trust these people. You can also kind of understand that hostility is going to increase toward these groups. So how does this play into all of that?
Well, it's interesting because there's a love-hate relationship with the Jewish peddler. And we find this relationship when we actually talk about credit markets in Europe and the role that Jews played in those markets. Jews were loved because they brought, if I'm out in South Dakota in the middle of nowhere, that peddler is my only way to get the things that I need, new seeds for planting, perhaps, that I don't have, shovels, if I need a shovel, or I need some manufactured good that cannot be had, because out in my rural area, there may be no store. There was the Sears catalog, which was started, but again, this was an expensive place to shop, and it would take a very long time to have things delivered. But the peddler might come through once a month, and you could count on that guy coming through, and he would have pots and pans and buckets or new saddles or a new plow or the types of things that you would need to survive. So, and, you know, sometimes he would even carry mail. So this was someone that you would look forward to seeing because he was so important to your survival. Yet on the other hand, it's like, boy, is he strange. And here's the problem. I don't have any cash. So when he comes by and I need a new plow, what am I going to do? Well, I have a pig. I have an extra pig. Maybe I can trade him my pig for the plow. So we strike an agreement. What's the problem, though? If I am so far from the markets, I may not know what the price of my pig is. Now I have to trust him to say, well, I'm going to give you this much for the pig. How do I know I'm getting a good price?
Aha, the lemons problem.
We get right back to the lemons problem. So while I love to see him, I also dread seeing him because I don't want to be cheated and I can't trust him. And furthermore, that distrust is reinforced because if my family and I travel to the nearest city where you can buy a pig, I may see that I sold my pig for a lot less than I could buy it in the city. Well, there again, we have the middleman, right? Buy low, sell high. Somebody has to have the cost of transporting that pig to market, right? So there's costs there, but I don't see them. All I see is, wow, he got away with murder because I sold him my pig for, you know, 10 bucks and I could have gotten 15 from the market here. And I don't see that, oh, yeah, I would have had to transport the pig, and by the time I walked the pig for 3 days, it probably would have been a much lighter weight pig. So you don't see these things. All you see is this love-hate relationship. Because you don't trust these people, you're pretty sure they're cheating you at every chance they get, and yet you need them for your survival. So the hostility tends to build, right, which... Now, here's where the really interesting thing happens. That hostility is what keeps the peddlers then tied to their network. Because if they weren't tied to their network, if they could defect and just go buy the farm next to yours or buy a stake someplace and start their own pioneering lifestyle, they might choose to do that. But they aren't able to do that because none of their neighbors will trust them. None of their neighbors will associate with them. None of their neighbors will pray with them. They are cut off from society. So they can't. And that hostility is what keeps them in that network.
It's very interesting that this is happening, and us economists would tend to say that this is a endogeneity problem or endogeneity effect, in that it something that keeps you tied to your group increases tension with the outside culture, who is also looking for signals, can I trust you or not, which then intensifies the entire connection back to your own group. So it's feeds on itself.
What starts as they hate me becomes, I can't do this because they hate me. It's not, you know, a one-way thing anymore. It becomes, I'm going to change my behavior because of my perception of how I will be treated on the outside. So I won't go outside anymore. I'm going to stay inside. You see this with children who perceive themselves as different from the cool kids. They will often say, build up a resistance. They don't want to meet new people because, not that they don't need new friends or wouldn't like new friends, but they're afraid of being rejected. And this is just a far more, I guess, tangible way of saying people don't want to be rejected. So they're going to stay within their networks. They're going to build those networks. The hostility that's there that prevents people from escaping those networks also at the same time reinforces the networks as people's fear of that rejection builds. And of course, then you add to it the Jewish history of being expelled from countries and blamed for all sorts of things that perhaps were never their fault in the first place. And what you have is the perfect self-reinforcing mechanism built inside this hostility framework.
I want to ask a question that is from the framework of the person who is purchasing things from the peddler. And methodologically, this might be a little bit difficult to untangle using empirical analysis. But so there's hostility building up toward Jews. They're the middlemen. They're the ones, they could be potentially cheating me. They're charging me too little of a price for my pig that I want to trade for those shovels. And so you're rather upset by that. But on the other hand, this endogeneity, could they be thinking of the fact that, you know, because they're so disliked and they have no other options other than doing this, and that since they have no other options, if they become dishonest and get a reputation for being dishonest, including within their own network, which it taints their network as being dishonest, that would be a death sentence for them. So therefore, I tend to trust them a little bit more.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Now, it could be, but again, that might be taking it a step too far, because the average person is going to be basing their decisions on their own experience. So if my experience is I sold that pig for 10 and he sold it for 15, I should be getting that extra 5, then I might think that he's cheating me when actually he's not. He's offering me the best price because his information, again, as you say, he has a huge incentive to maintain good relationships with people, to get them the things that they need. If I pass by your house and you want knitting needles, then next time I'm by, if I can bring knitting needles, I'm going to do it because I want to make that sale. It's good for you, but it's also good for me. And as long as we have this great relationship, we can continue. So the incentives on the part of the peddler are to continue with good business dealings, because in many cases, these are repeated customers.
Yeah. The iteration becomes important.
Right. It's definitely a repeated game type of effect. You don't cheat because you're going to play another version of the game, you know, down the road. So the and again, you bring up a very good point about I, as a peddler, if I'm perceived as cheating people and that gets back to my boss, that's going to be bad for him because I'm not going to be able to make as many sales as someone that people can trust. So, you know, again, I may ruin my own network, and I can't do that because I have no other network to go to. And no one else will hire me. No one else will trust me. So this is it. So I think that type of reputational enforcement really kept a lot of the dealings far more honest, even if they weren't always perceived as being honest.
Yeah.
Because again, the role of the middleman is misunderstood and traditionally always has been.
Yeah, this is why I love this stuff so much, because it just reveals insights that we might be doing subconsciously, much like going to your aunt's house for oyster stew, but yet has its own social logic to it that keeps things moving along.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Let me go ahead and close out here with one of our typical questions that we asked of all our guests. And that is, how has working on this project and looking at Jewish peddlers informed you about things more broadly, perhaps things in contemporary times? Is there anything that we can learn from the 18th century Jewish experience for our own lives today?
Well, I guess one of the biggest takeaways for me is when you look at behavior you do not understand, that you have to sort of think about why would this person choose to behave in that way? And I used to think, I went to UCLA as an undergraduate, and I remember walking through campus and seeing, you know, some of the folks with the shaved heads and the saffron robes and tambourines, and I kept thinking, why on earth would anyone do that? And as you start to peel back, you know, the incentives for that behavior, what are the costs of the behavior, those are pretty apparent. But what we don't always see are the benefits of inclusion in different groups. And this is something that Larry Iannacone explores in his work a great deal, which has really influenced me. What are the benefits? It's not always, religious participation is not always just about salvation. That's a nice end game, but again, most religions have this ability for you to sort of convert at the end of life. You're forgiven of everything, you're rebaptized perhaps, and all is good. So why on earth wouldn't we all live a life of wonderful excess and sin, and then just at the last minute convert? The truth is that there's a lot more to belonging to a group, to community, to the value of association with others than we really think about. And most religions deal with that kind of communal observance, the type of community building. After all, very few churches say, here's a book on what you should believe. You go home and you stay by yourself and you'll be just fine. Most religions say, no, come join us. And your participation in that group is reinforced by the enthusiastic participation of other people. And that is part of the value that a lot of people don't see. Again, if we're just looking at dollars and cents, which many people think economics is, it doesn't make sense to give up all of your worldly goods to join a faith where you will live in poverty. But it might make sense on a lot of other dimensions. So just the idea of looking beyond what you think is unusual behavior to question, well, why? Why would someone do that? What's the logic here?
That is always a good question to be asking, and you are one of the people who ask that questions a lot and fills us in with these answers. I know you're working on some stuff, as you mentioned earlier, on African tribes, so we're going to have to keep an eye on what you're doing there and have you back on the show. My guest today has been Colleen Haight. Colleen, thanks for being on the show today.
Thanks a lot, Tony. I have really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.